Hello, everyone. My name's Tom. I'm from the University of Auckland, so thanks for having me. Paderborn's actually the first place I've ever been to in Europe, so it was very exciting to come here. I came straight from the plane here. I also want to acknowledge the Australian Accounting Standards Board, because part of the work of this paper was done when I was a sabbatical fellow, so thanks very much, ASB. And, of course, my two co-authors, Nafiz and Laura, are from Massey University in New Zealand. So I think everyone's pretty familiar with the problem, but let me just go over it a little bit. And the problem we have is that people are contesting that accounting is not doing a great job of representing the modern drivers of firm value. And essentially, there's argued to be a difference and an increasing difference between the recognized book value of the firm and the true value of the firm, the market value, as we could perhaps proxy with the market to book ratio. And this gap is, of course, got a lot bigger in the information age as we increasingly have digital assets and are the drivers of value. And this is important because we use the financial statements for a whole range of reasons, right? We use it for contracting, monitoring, and it means that these intangible driven firms have understated earnings, they have look more risky because they have less assets on the balance sheet, so their leverage ratio is worse, and that can affect them in a whole bunch of ways. One asset I've long been interested in is people. We often hear things like the most important asset to a company is its people. You know, this is kind of like a glib thing we can see in the business media. And essentially, there's very little recognition of people, but we know people really matter to the success of a business. And so, and that's been shown, by the way, in literature from both in accounting and outside accounting, where they show things like the turnover ratio is associated with firm value. And there's also been surveys by the ISB asking for more information on human capital. There's different solutions to this problem. Some solutions are sort of KPI driven, so they want more information on things like turnover ratio. Other people sort of adopt an ESG sort of lens of human capital, of modern slavery things. But what I argue is that there's a difference between recognition and disclosure. And what we really want is recognition of this human capital, because we know from other accounting literature that there is a difference in how we value information that is simply disclosed in the notes to recognized on the face. So disclosure doesn't actually solve all our problems of a missing gap. So I think we want to try to recognize more intangible assets, and particularly human capital on the balance sheet. Some people said, well, why don't we capitalize all expenses that relate to investments in human capital and put it on the balance sheet or functions of that? I kind of think that would be unlikely to get support from a broad range of constituents. Other people say, what about capitalizing just training expense, right? The problem with that approach is that the human capital we're really interested in is the really high valued people, right? And training often relates more to just the more rank and file employees, so it doesn't give us that information on the really high value employees. And so it doesn't solve that problem either. And so, you know, we've got, well, he's gone already, but we've got the quote that, you know, there's lots of problems here, but essentially there's a lot of difference on how to solve the problem. There is, of course, existing literature. So just to go over it sort of briefly, intangible assets are value relevant. They're related to the stock prices, but also uncapitalized intangible assets are value relevant. Okay, so we know that both intangibles and things that aren't yet recognized, like development expenses, are important. Estimates of intangibles that aren't in the balance sheet are also value relevant. However, on the flip side, accounting information seems to have become less useful over time. So we've got this other really stream of literature that sort of alludes to that point I was saying before about trying to capitalize all expenditure relating to intangibles, which tries to create essentially a function of these expenditures, perhaps relating to marketing expense or a function of employee expenses, and capitalizes that and shows that relates to firm value. But as I said, those sorts of issues, those sorts of solutions to the missing gap of intangibles would appear unlikely to me to be adoptable in a broad sense. One place we do see human capital on the balance sheet is, of course, I'm going to say soccer, right, being from New Zealand. But I suspect most of the room would rather I say football. Yes, I mean, someone's nodding. So we can capitalize the transfer fee for football players, right? And here is an extract from Celtic's annual report, and we can see that they've capitalized the transfer fee they've played for various football players. And the argument here is that meets the definition of an intangible asset because we have the transaction and they have control because they can stop the person playing for another team. And we can also measure it reliably, which is one of the concerns around intangibles. Interestingly enough, the accounting for football players essentially has the same problems as the rest of intangible assets, that they complain that they can't revalue it upwards, they can only impair it downwards, and so on. So equally, again, even though this is a solution, it does seem to be an area that has some concerns still. So when we were thinking about where we could recognize human capital in the balance sheet, what we started thinking about is, obviously most people aren't football players, or perhaps they are casually, but what would be something that would be more common in the business world that would be the most analogous situation to a football player where they can't just go play for another team, right? And what we came up with was non-compete agreements or non-compete clauses. So for those of you who don't know, a non-compete agreement is when you work for a company and you restrict it for working for another company after your employment ends for a period of time. They're often also bundled with non-disclosure agreements at the same time. You can't approach customers, you can't approach suppliers, you can't talk to your co-workers about setting up a rival company. They stop you from working. So we can see that that non-compete agreement in some ways is getting similar to the idea of a football player who can't just go play for the rival football club, so to speak. They also, just to talk a little bit of background about them, they can't just be applied in a wide scope. Generally, for example, the idea underpinning a lot of them is they must be reasonable, right? So if you're a plumber in Auckland, you can't be restricted from being a plumber in the rest of New Zealand. It's probably going to be confined to just Auckland. It's going to be confined to just being a plumber, right? It can't stop you from working in another trade or being an accountant. They also are unlikely to apply immediately. Right, so if you start working for a company and sign a non-compete agreement and then you just decide to quit the next day, your non-compete agreement is probably not going to be enforceable. The non-disclosure agreement part of it might be enforceable, but the non-compete agreement component would probably say something like, you haven't yet developed the connections and the human capital with that company to have anything to prohibit you working against them. You know, being an academic, I obviously don't have a non-compete agreement, but they are actually surprisingly common. We found some stats that say about 1 in 5 companies in America and Australia use non-compete agreements. It's not just an American or Australian thing. For example, we found another stat that defined high-skilled workers in Finland, and 37% of them have non-compete agreements. So they are more common than we may think, at least as academics, where we don't have them. And so what we argue is this could be an intangible asset. And we think it could be because it is pretty close to meeting the intangible asset criteria already, to this extent that maybe the intangible asset standard doesn't need to be amended, which would be handy from getting it across the line, and we could solve it with a FRIC guidance note or something more casual. So first of all, we argue that it arises from a legal contract because the non-compete agreement is signed, so that makes it identifiable. It's important to note at this point that this isn't as crazy idea as you may think, and actually non-compete agreements actually already are assets on the balance sheets of company, but only when they are done through consolidation currently. Okay, so it's actually a very modest step to say non-compete agreement should go from being identifiable when we acquire them as part of another company to that they are always identifiable because there is an underpinned legal contract that is enforceable in law. The other advantage non-compete agreements have, relative to many other intangible assets, is that they're actually directly measurable and attributable to the human capital, right? So we would say that you would capitalize, if the non-compete agreement was saying for 6 months you couldn't work for someone else, you would capitalize 6 months of that person's salary on the balance sheet. And so that really has an advantage over other proposals because we can directly attribute the 6 months of that salary to that person's human capital and then capitalize it. So the directly attributable and measurability issues are alleviated, maybe solved is a strong word, alleviated is the word I'm gonna go for. There's also probable benefits. Benefits, of course, don't have to be cash, right? In this case, we say the benefit is a reduced product market competition for the company. And reduced product market competitions have been noted elsewhere by IFRIC to saying that they are a benefit consistent with meeting the asset criteria. As an aside, no one ever tells you this, but in sport or media, we sometimes hear of people getting their non-compete agreement bought out for cash. So that's kind of anecdotal evidence that people think these things have value as well. If it's legally enforceable, then it does arise from past event and present control. We also think that non-compete agreements are a really sensible approach to recognising human capital because they meet the idea that what we're really interested in with having human capital on the balance sheet is our unique and highly valued employees, the ones that the company can protect and is most interested in protecting, which is the ones with a non-compete agreement. And so really it's a narrow scope addition to intangible assets that we're proposing here. So what we're really interested in is, does this idea we have actually matter? So does it actually change the recognized accounting numbers? Does it make them more useful? Does it partly alleviate these problems we have? So we're interested in knowing, does it increase the usefulness of accounting information? And does it change them for that stewardship, monitoring, and contracting perspectives we talked about as well? Here's just a simple example of essentially what we're proposing. Plus, it's always nice to have a journal entry in the first presentation of the day, right? We go just from having debit, employee costs, and credit cash to essentially saying, well, if 30% of our employees have a non-compete agreement, we would slowly capitalize that over the lifetime until it's fully ramped up. So we would just recognize 7.5, in this case, as a non-compete asset, and then you would amortize that over its life, okay? So you wouldn't recognize all of the non-compete agreement at once. You would recognize it over a period it becomes enforceable, say 2 years. You don't recognize 6 months' salary every year. You just recognize it once and then keep on adjusting it for changes in their salary and so forth. What country do we do this in? We do this study in New Zealand. I promise you, it's not because I'm a New Zealander for once. Although New Zealand is a handy setting to do research in because we do use IFRS and ISAs. The reason we do this in New Zealand is that New Zealand has a weird law that says that all listed companies must disclose the number of employees that earn above $100,000 in $10,000 bands, right? So 100,000 New Zealand, that New Zealand's 2 to 1 with the euro, so 50,000 euros, for example. And so that's really important because we don't know how many of these employees actually have a non-compete agreement, but by knowing the number of employees that are highly valued, I can create an estimate of those that are likely to have a non-compete agreement and only capitalize the ones above a threshold. So we can create an accurate estimate of the employees we think would have a non-compete agreement rather than just capitalizing the whole employee expense by doing this in New Zealand. This is the warehouse, which is like our Walmart in New Zealand. And you can just see that they've disclosed it in bands, right? Just prove my point. So you can see the CEO presumably is earning $2.79 million, right? So we capitalize only these higher valued. To do the capitalization, we essentially try to mimic the literature that was out there on capitalizing operating leases when we had that change in lease standards and assume a going concern and make some assumptions to be able to do this. So in our main test, we assume a six-month non-enforceable period because that's the most common length of time in New Zealand. We capitalise those who earn above 130,000 New Zealand. I know that seems like a random number, but that's because a politician in New Zealand said that that should be a threshold for being able to have them, so it seemed like a sensible cutoff. We say that they become enforceable after 2 years, so we sort of ramp it up over 2 years. Again, that's based on some sort of stuff in New Zealand saying that they would be unlikely to be enforceable after the first year, so a two-year ramp up. We amortise it over a six-year lifetime, and again, that's because that's actually the average turnover ratio of employees in New Zealand. And we assume at the start that they have 40% accumulated amortisation on the opening balance, and that's based on a survey of Intangibles New Zealand, which noted that to be the average amount of accumulated amortisation intangibles have in New Zealand. So we are trying to make these reasonable assumptions, and what we do is we capitalise this proportion of employee expense for each year, we subtract it from employee costs, which then change profit, we add it to assets, we of course have amortization, which also affects profit, and of course equity is adjusted as well. This is the formula we go through to do it. So we have our initial opening balance to kind of get the it up and running, and then we only have to adjust for changes in it, which adjust for changes in the employees each year. So you can see the key bits are we only adjust for 6 months of the salary, not the whole year, and we ramp it up over 2 years, which is the half. Okay, so here is the descriptive statistics. So just to note, this creates a new asset worth about $30 million, right? 30 million New Zealand, 50 million euros. But again, our companies aren't that big, right? So it is a small increase in intangibles. But it is, I guess, proportionate to the same. You can see they've gone from 194 million and we're at intangibles pre this, and we're adding on average a $30 million new asset to that. So it's a sizable increase. One thing we do to try to validate our new measure is we rank all the companies that we do this to by the new asset we create as a proportion of assets, and we find essentially, the list of companies is exactly what we hope it would look like, that the ones with the highest proportion of this new asset are software companies, R&D companies, and the ones with the lowest are ones that we wouldn't expect to have much human capital. So it does seem like it's kind of working as we intend. But it doesn't matter. So here what we find is that relative to before we create this new asset, which we think is a good idea, we actually have a significant increase in, a significant improvement in leverage. You can see that the leverage ratio decreases by 1%. We have a significant improvement in profitability. It goes up as well from 4.7% to 5.2%. More intangibles, and we see a decrease in the market to book ratio because, of course, the market value doesn't change, but the book value changes. So we have significantly reduced the missing gap. Hopefully. When I was doing all those assumptions before, you probably thought to yourself, they seem a bit arbitrary. Does the result hold if you change all those assumptions? The answer is yes, right? We have lots of fun and we change every single assumption we made in different directions and we pretty much find the same sort of result. We find same results when we look at it just by year. We find same results when we look at it just by industry in general of the same improvement. Next, we go on and we do a value relevance test to see if there's a significant improvement in the usefulness of accounting information. So we're essentially looking at if accounting information, earnings, and the book value of earnings and the book value of equity is associated with the share price, whether that can explain more when we redo it with our new accounting numbers, with our new non-compete agreement as an asset. We'll just go over that. And that's what we find. We find that the adjusted R squared increases significantly when we use our new accounting numbers that we pretend would be there with our non-compete agreements being capitalized. So we explain more accounting information when we start to capitalize human capital. I would note that some people are probably thinking it, so I will agree. The increase in the adjusted R squared is fairly small, but that's consistent with our ethos of trying to have a very narrow additional intangible asset, right? We are only adding another a small intangible asset, so we wouldn't expect the adjusted R squared to triple, right? We would just expect to see a small increase because we're making a small change. Next, we rerun the value relevance tests by subsamples for whether it is a more or less knowledge-driven industry, a knowledge-driven company. So whether they have a higher proportion of intangibles or whether they're in an industry with more human capitals, which is like your tech, your software, etc. We find that our results only hold in these more knowledge-driven companies, so the ones with higher intangibles or more human capital intensive, and they actually flip in the low human capital intensive industries. So this is consistent with our solution being a good idea for companies that currently have a big missing gap and have currently have these problems that we talked about in the first slide, and potentially a bad idea for these ones that still rely more on tangibles. Those value relevance tests I just talked about, we rerun them with changing all our assumptions that I showed you before, and we find the same results. We also do an alternative value relevance test where we have our non-compete agreement as a separate asset that we remove out of the book value of equity and rerun it, and we find that that is value relevant, providing support. We try to say that maybe this is just a signal for having high-valued employees, so we include the number of employees we have there as a control and find it doesn't change it. Just before I continue, I think it's, you know, I really want to thank our reviewer for suggesting the slide, but there's going to be lots of costs from this as well, unfortunately. So I think the literature would say that non-compete agreements can reduce mobility of employees, so that's obviously a downside. I found out today that Germany apparently has lots of non-compete agreements, but we could see a lack of international comparability between countries with high use of non-compete agreements and low non-compete agreements. It provides an opportunity for earnings management as well. And I think both accrual in terms of changing the assumptions and real in terms of if you're putting employees on or not on non-compete agreements just to get access to this. And of course, this seems pretty hard to audit, so we might see an increase in audit fees. So in conclusion, hopefully we've contributed to the long-standing debate on this missing gap of intangibles, and that we've sort of added by, hopefully we've added to this by having a very narrow but very precise extra intangible that is kind of more closely grounded in the current accounting standards, and we show that it improves the usefulness. However, you could say alternatively that we've created a monster, but it's at least a very cute little monster, right? Because it's small. And that's me. Thank you.